Kelly's Heroes. My next guest on Kelly's Heroes. He is the top of his field. He is amazing. He is one of the best artists out there, and I have the privilege of calling him now. Where are you? My next actual guest. There you go. Let's give you a call.
Hey.
Hello. Is that Mr. Jonathan? Yeah, I'm good. Is that Mr. Jonathan Yeo?
Yes, it is.
How are you? It's Monsieur Craig Kelly.
Yeah. Your number came up, so it must have come that long since I spoke to you.
Well, when was the last time that you spoke to me? Was it in Groucho?
Well, it must have been. Yeah, I mean, it must be quite a while.
Yeah.
It's a different time in life. How's it going?
It's going great, mate. I'm currently in my airing cupboard, which is a really cozy womb-like place. I think it'd be good for you to paint, actually, Jonathan.
Is it light enough in there, though?
Don't bother with me. I would paint the washing machines because they're far more interesting. So, have you heard any of these, Jonathan?
You know, I haven't heard any of them.
Oh, brilliant.
It's disastrous.
Lamb to the slaughter. You are a lamb to the slaughter, mate. This is beautiful. I want to hit you with something, Jonathan, right?
Yeah.
And it's not a rhythm stick, right? But let me take you back to when we first met, because I believe it was at some celeb poker televised tournament, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Now, were you playing on my table?
I feel like I was. Was that the one we went down to Cardiff to do?
Yes. But I remember getting the train back with you, right?
Or maybe I
got the train up with you. But what I want to know is, were you on... Because what happened with me, right, was I'd never played poker before, right? Which is great. But I was given the gig and I thought, well, you know, how hard can it be? I actually learnt the rules of Texan Hold'em on the way to Cardiff, going live on the same table as Martin Amis, Sir Clive Sinclair, and possibly you, right? And all I can remember thinking was, how can I not be out first? Proper poker sharks, proper legends, and a little old me, was I basically pretended that I didn't know my from my elbow, and I didn't know the etiquette of poker. And I actually got slaughtered for it by all my friends and various people. And they were like, and I was like, mate, the reason why I was asking Martin Amis if I should check or not was because I was playing him. And they were like, but you can't ask a poker player to if you should check or not. And I said, I know, but I didn't want to be out first. But I mean, is that really, really bad of me, Jonathan, to have done that? It kind of is, isn't it?
No, I think I love that. I have to say, I hadn't been playing poker for very long. I'd actually started playing only about, I think, 3 or 4 years before as an occasional thing. I'd started playing with Dexter Fletcher.
Yes.
And Jason Fleming.
Yes.
You're probably mates of yours as well.
Yes, they are.
The reason, I don't think they'll mind me saying this, the reason that they wanted to learn to play poker was they just made a film called Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, which which was obviously part of the storyline was about a poker game.
That's right. That's right.
And in the course of playing it, they started to learn because out of the goodness of their heart, well, his heart, Matthew Vaughan, the producer, had been teaching them how to play on set.
Yeah.
Anyway, the net result was, they owed Matthew so much money by the end of shooting, they had to do all the reshoots for free.
What?
and they were a bit miffed about this. And so the idea was they'd learn to play, and we'd get good at it. And then I think at some point the plan was to get Matthew round once they'd learned, and then fleece him. Anyway,
did it happen?
We did get Matthew round to play a couple of times with us actually. But the nice thing was, it became such a regular thing. I mean, we don't do it all the time, but we must meet up about sort of four times a year to play. And it's more of a social event than anything else.
What,
but
you still do it now?
We still do it to this day. So it's 20 years later, we're still doing it. And I actually sort of met up with them just before we were all locked down again recently, for the first time, you know, since the COVID.
Yeah.
And had a little game with a little group, and the group's widened a bit. But there's like a sort of dozen of us who play fairly regularly. I'm still not very good. I still generally lose.
How much money do you play for?
Well, we try not to play very much. I mean, once in a while, you'll have a cash game, which can get a bit silly. But on the whole, we just like buy in for kind of 50 quid or something. And then you're going to top it up a couple of times. So you're not usually down more than you would be on a sort of, you know, an extravagant night out, basically. And occasionally you win, but not very often in my case.
Is there drink consumed?
I'm afraid there is still quite, you know, there is still booze involved.
Oh, that sounds nice. Do you have a little cheeky bourbon or something?
Yeah.
What's your tip? What's your poker drink, Jonathan?
Poker drink. We seem to have been drinking a lot of Negronis recently. But basically everyone has their own thing. So lovely Jamie Oliver, when he plays, is more of a whiskey man.
Yeah.
Dexter, I would say, was drinking vodka last time. Keith Tyson, who's an artist friend of mine,
yes,
was on the tequila. I think he's on some sort of diet that involves, I think, tequila. And then, but there's, you know, there's generally a sort of like a reasonable selection.
Did you say a diet that involves tequila?
Yeah, I think he was trying to explain it to me. This keto thing where, you know, it's a sort of, it's to do with the amount of the type of carbs involved in the alcohol, I think.
Okay.
Well, maybe it's vodka. Maybe it's vodka actually he's on. I think because vodka, even though it's made from potatoes,
it's good for you.
Still one of the lowest in terms of, yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, if I was ever on a health kick, I would always go to a vodka, lime and soda. Do you know what I mean? A vodka, lime and soda. And it felt very, very good for me. I think it's because of the lack of sugar.
How many vodka, lime and sodas would you have on your health kick?
I would have a lot, and I would be very, very hungover. And I would think, why am I so hungover?
You feel more healthy because of it.
Yeah, but I was lean. I was lean, and that was the main thing.
You're listening to Kelly's Heroes. Please subscribe, and please leave a review.
What are you up to at the moment, Jonathan?
Well, this year's been a bit fragmented.
Yes.
As it has, I guess, for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And what I did was, because I couldn't do my normal kind of way of painting and having people in the studio, I started two little side projects. One was to see if I could paint people remotely using FaceTime and an iPad.
I saw that. It was brilliant.
Good, yeah. Well, that was the other thing. Because once you're starting to like, you know, have it coming through the, you know, the screen and using technology to capture it, it then made sense to stream it and show people what I was doing. Cause people always asking to come and watch while I work, and it's often a bit impractical in the studio to actually have people in, and it's a bit distracting. But actually, to do it via the cameras was a lovely thing. Some were watching, I think, to learn how to do it, and some were watching just for the chat. And so Dexter was one of them, obviously.
Yes.
Fern Cotton and Professor Brian Cox and Jamie Oliver were the four I've done so far. And actually, I probably won't be doing it all the time because it does take up quite a bit of time. But I would definitely keep it going because actually it's an interesting way to work. It does mean you can get people to sit for you where geography would otherwise be a problem, or just the kind of like your tightness of their schedule. And I think it'll be something, it's quite a nice long-term record to have of these things. I've never recorded the sitting before. And actually it's quite an interesting thing to look back on. So I will keep it going. So that's been a good upshot of the lockdown. And the other thing, I haven't really answered your question about doing on painting because I haven't really fully got back into work yet.
Right.
I mean, so like slightly sidetracked by other projects. But the other thing was, I mean, we decided to try and make an app because we've been doing various techie things in the studio, and we've been working on a VR project for a while.
It's extremely cool, mate. I've got it. It's extremely cool. I've seen it. It's brilliant. It's amazing.
Fantastic. Well, it also became more interesting because it works very well. It's very successful. The studio, my painting studio, becomes like an object on a table, but you also go into a full immersion mode and you can move around it and explore it, and you can look behind things and discover things. And we've hidden a few little bits of content around it.
Yeah.
And I think we'll carry on adding things to it over the coming months, and potentially do even sort of virtual exhibitions and events and a lot more about the sort of process of making things. So again, it sort of relates to the other thing, the FaceTime portraits.
Yeah.
And you can see a bit of how I was doing that. But it's one of those things where actually I think having made this thing and got through the, you know, the difficult labor of bringing it into the world, it's now something we can add to in a really interesting way. And I think in the coming years, we may be able to do a VR version and other things as well. So hopefully it's another thing which was, you know, not really scheduled for this year, but yes, it's been a worthwhile little experiment.
One of the only good things about COVID is the amount of creativity that's gone on in the world. It seems like you've done those two projects that you've talked about because of COVID, right? In the same way that I'm speaking to you from my airing cupboard.
Yes. So your thing, so this yours is the COVID-inspired exercise as well.
Well, yes, because I bought all this beautiful kit and I put it in my airing cupboard because it's the best soundproofed place in my home. It's for voiceovers and for documentaries, etc., etc. But I thought, well, I've got a bit of time on my hands. I've always wanted to do a podcast. I like talking. I know some great people who happen to be mates who are brilliant in their field. So I'll just call them up and press record. And that's sort of what I've done. But what I normally start with, Jonathan, is questions from my children. And I think they're always just really lovely, sweet questions. And I'm going to ask you them, okay?
Okay, yeah.
This is from Vinny, who's 4. And he wanted to know, what do you cook like?
Cook like?
Yeah, what do you cook like? I said, what question have you got for my next guest? And he went, what does he cook like?
Well, I mean, what I like to cook is tend to be things that are kind of involve not too much intervention. So like this weekend, I went to the fishmonger and got a lot of very nice fresh fish.
Nice.
Where you don't have to do very much to it.
Nice.
I would think, I'd say stuff like fairly simple things with good ingredients. What do I cook like? I tend to cook in a fairly minimalist way. I mean, when I was younger and had more time for it, I'd be cooking curries and stews and all kinds of more complex recipes. These days, I like to get a nice bit of fish or meat,
yes,
and not have to do very much, and to, you know, basically to roast it, fry it, occasionally barbecue it, or grill it, and certainly do things where you can add a few ingredients and let the good ingredients do their thing, basically. I would say that's my favourite thing. Discovered tarama salata recently, actually.
Ooh.
After a trip to Greece, my daughter and I were kind
is
of like got
one?
Interested in this idea of, yeah, exactly. And there are certain things you can do involving using ice cold water or even actual ice, we've tried, which make it some lighter and fluffier. And if you kind of like, it can be quite heavy if you mix it wrong, but it basically is just cod's roe and olive oil, pretty much. And you can add a few little things to it.
See, I don't fancy it, you know. I don't fancy
it. It's all in how you do it. And if you do it in the right way, you make it really light and fluffy. It's
really
amazing.
Because I was just in Greece recently and I ate my own weight in hummus, but I didn't touch that stuff. I don't know what it is. I eat everything, anything and everything. And for some reason, I didn't go near it. And you'd have thought that I would have, but I'm somehow scared of the fish eggs, it seems.
Ah.
Do you know what I mean?
Well,
I'm not really a caviar
kind of
guy.
Well, maybe they'll convert you if you try ours.
Well, I'll try yours, mate, because you're an artist, mate. I'm sure it tastes amazing. Do you cook a lot, though? Or is it like, are you a bit like me where you cook well when you can find the time, shall we say? Or are you just like painting in the studio, coming back and going, I'm going to put something on here? I mean, who cooks more in your household?
My wife definitely cooks more than I do. I tend to cook a bit of weekend. I find, I'm not sure I cook well, but certainly the thing I still love about it is the sort of meditative aspect of it, that when you start to do something, whether it takes 15 minutes or an hour and a half, when you're in the zone of doing it, your thoughts are totally on what you're doing.
Yes.
And so you forget about everything else that's bothering you or obsessing you elsewhere in life.
Yes.
And actually, I find that a really healthy thing as a way of cleansing the brain, really.
Yeah.
But it's a bit like a meditation. And I think you can do that. It gets you sort of not kind of like continuing your usual internal dialogue in your mind.
Yes.
I think it's a really useful thing, and cooking has always been a bit like that for me.
Do you have, is it ADHD or ADD?
Yes, ADD, exactly.
Okay. Can you, because I really want to ask you about that, because my wife thinks I might have that. I mean, I'm not sure if she's right, but the way that I can describe it is I do sometimes find it hard to concentrate, and there's a lot that goes on in my mind at any one given point. A bit like this podcast now. I'm not only focusing on our conversation, there's quite a few things that are going on in my mind. Is it a bit like that?
Yes. So I think ADHD is where you have hyperactivity as well.
Yes.
And
yes.
I think that's a bit more of a normal thing in sort of youngsters, especially sort of, you know, kind of teen and preteen boys. Yeah. ADD is just as, I think it's just as prevalent. I got diagnosed late in life. It was about 6 or 7 years ago. Although, of course, as soon as you realize that absolutely you affected how you were at school. I think basically what it is, the quick version of it, it's an inability of the brain to decide, to choose what it focuses on. And it can have all kinds of sort of like, other secondary effects as well.
Yeah.
But effectively, the thing that most people can do, and this is an actual sort of thing that they've studied and seen, the neuroscientists have kind of like wired people up to sort of monitor brain activity.
Yes.
And literally, I think the frontal cortex, which is the thing that makes you kind of, for instance, decide if something's urgent and needs immediate attention and focus.
Yeah,
it kind of does the opposite of what it's supposed to if you've got ADD. So sometimes the more urgent something is, the less you're able to do it.
Really?
Which can be a bit of a problem.
Yes.
I think the flip side of it is, it's difficult at school. I could never advise for exams. I could never do things like that. When most people would, the things that most people would be able to do under pressure, I find the opposite was the case. And apparently that is quite a normal thing when you have this. What's interesting is that actually it can be very good for creativity.
Yes.
Because what it means is that your brain, it's not that you can't focus.
Yeah.
It just means you have to be interested in it. And therefore, in my case, and I think the same with a lot of artists I know, they are very good at what they're starting on something that's interesting them creatively. They can absolutely focus on that and not be aware of what's going on in the world around them or anywhere else at all.
Yeah.
And that means you can actually get a huge amount done in the right circumstances. I think that I've described it to people as being a creative superpower used in the right way.
Yes. That's an amazing thing to think of.
I'm lucky to be doing something where I can make use of it. And I think it's very difficult for people if they're doing jobs where it makes it harder for them.
Yeah. Is there drugs and stuff that you've had to have taken in your time? Do you take drugs for that now, or do you meditate, or is it just your painting that helps you?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, so all of the above, really. I mean, I do have medication for it, and I don't take it all the time.
Yes.
But it is very useful to have that when you need to focus on something that you wouldn't choose to otherwise.
Yeah.
Meditation is famously good for it. There's certain other things. There's certain kind of vitamins and minerals and things like magnesium.
Yeah.
But I think, and different people have different sort of variations of it too. I think there's like, it's not completely the same thing in everyone.
Yeah.
It's something which they've known about it in kids for 40, 50 years, I think, in general. I mean, in this country, they've only recognized it really more recently than that, and in adults more recently still. So it's something which is still developing, and I think a lot of people do have it without knowing it. Hopefully it's one of those things which people will understand more in the coming years. And I suspect that it's also, guess is that not yeah that actually it's these things which are seen as disorders now and the other thing too are actually just everyone's brains are wired a bit differently and different education for instance suits some people in this traditional way better than others, and I think in years to come we'll find that it'll be much more calibrated according to your own the way your brain works, and we'll know much more about how different people need to be presented with things and what circumstances they work better and harder and faster and that kind of thing. How does it affect you? What way does it manifest in you?
I'm not sure. It's something that I don't think that I've got, but my wife has spoken to a couple of people who have it, who know me, and she's gone, oh, I think Craig's got that. And they've both said, apparently, yes, I think he has too. I don't know why she's come to that conclusion. Here's something. How do you find driving on a motorway for hours? Does that affect you in any way?
I don't find it. I mean, I don't do it much these days, to be honest. Right. When I'm back when I used to, in my youth, it wasn't really a problem. I did find it easier if I had something to listen to. And actually, that's another thing about it, is that people with ADD often are able to concentrate better if there's music playing than if there's no sound at all, which is the opposite of, I think, how people normally find it. I did have to do homework or revise or do something that involved concentration. To have something going on which sort of is a background noise would make it easier, whereas no sound would be quite distracting. There are things like that which are sort of little quirks of the condition.
Well, I mean I get really tired basically, and she thinks it's because I find it hard to concentrate, so that's one of the signs that she thinks is...
I definitely need a coffee or two before I set out on a long journey. One of the other things, the lockdown, we bought a clever electric car at the beginning. We bought it before, but it came just before the lockdown started. We haven't had much chance to use it. But supposedly it can drive itself on motorways, and I'm itching to give it a go. But no one else in my family wants to come and test it out with me. They think it's dangerous.
No, it's very, very dangerous. I will be that nutter. I will be the one that gets in the front seat with you, mate. I mean, to be fair, I'll probably nod off. But actually, you've met me quite a few times. Do you think I've got it? Did it strike you that I might have the same thing?
I've only really known about it for about 6 years since I was diagnosed, and then started really reading about it. I mean, I then retrospectively applied it to about half of my creative friends, I would say, have it to a greater or lesser degree. And I think that it wouldn't surprise me at all if you had it.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't see it as a problem. I think the main problem for people is not knowing they've got it, but not knowing about it, because I think that it's the sort of thing where the impact on your life is greater if you don't know that you have it and you don't know what the implications are.
Absolutely.
But actually, for the most part, you can work around things and adapt to it. And also the people around you then know what to expect, and you're going to be, as soon as you put something down, you've lost it, basically. There are all kinds of things like that where they're exaggerated versions of things, traits that most of us have in small way, occasionally anyway, but they are much more amplified, and there's also much less you can do about it. But if you know it's a problem, then you develop systems basically for dealing with it and getting through life without getting in too much trouble.
But as you say, it's your superpower, which I absolutely love, because let's face it, you've absolutely smashed the living Scheisenhagen out of a job that is like being an astronaut. I mean, who can make a living from being an artist? What's amazing about it, actually, is my kids are showing real talent for art. And I look to someone like you, and I would not hold them back. If they say to me, I want to be an artist, I would say, you go for it, right? Because in a way, that's what you did when you were 22 or 23. Were you inspired by anyone, though? I mean, how do you not have a training and then you reach the top of your field? Is it because you haven't had a training? How is that even possible?
It's a good question. I mean, I think there's quite a luck involved, Craig, to be honest. But I think also at that time, in the early 90s, mid-90s, what I do painting, and I started off pretty much just painting portraits. Obviously, as years went on, I kind of diversified a bit into other areas, although to this day, it's mostly face-related in some way.
Yes.
And I think it was actually what was at the time seemed like a disadvantage actually turned into being an advantage. It's because no one else was really doing it at that time.
Yeah.
It was very out of fashion.
Yes.
Art schools weren't really teaching much painting at all.
Yeah.
It meant that there weren't many other people doing it. And so once I did start to get the hang of it, which took a while,
yeah.
but of course I started taking portraits because I liked faces. And of course, that was one way that I could make a bit of money because I could do commissions and paint people.
Yeah.
And that meant that I could effectively be paid to learn the job. And so it took a few years, I'd say. It probably wasn't until I'd been doing it for, you know, a decade or so that I'd really got the hang of it. Yeah. But it certainly, it was one of those things that I wouldn't have ever sort of sat down and planned my path as doing what I'd done. Yeah. But actually, it was a very fortuitous thing in retrospect, because actually, partly, as I say, you know, I was doing something where there wasn't much competition.
Yeah, that's handy.
And certainly not to be doing, so like, take something traditional and try and do it in a slightly different and experimental way. But also, I think, you know, it's been very useful then subsequently to whenever I want to go and explore a new area, whether I've done things involving some projects, exhibitions, where all the pictures are made from collages. I've done stuff around people having cosmetic surgery in recent years. As you know, I've been doing a lot more with technology as well.
Yeah.
It's much easier to go into a new area where people understand fundamentally where you're coming from. And so the fact that I do something very traditional as a sort of day job makes it much easier in a funny way to then go and do something much more experimental and unusual. Because people kind of sort of anchor it in their minds, I think, and they know what it is, what the sort of orthodoxy are that you are deviating from, that you're kind of, you know, pushing against. There's a lot of luck involved in every way. I mean, that path that I've chosen, that I've taken, has been something which actually has worked out well. And but in general, in the art world, there are lots of very lovely, talented people who don't get much recognition for it, and a few who get recognition, which perhaps they, you know, beyond what they deserve. But I think it's, you know, it's one of those things. So it's hard advising your kids, and I have that worry as well. You know, if they want to go and do that for a living, do you support them?
Yes.
Because it would be ridiculous not to, given actually enjoyed doing it. But at the same time, you know that it's unfair.
Yeah, I'm the same, because when I suddenly announced when I was 16 that I wanted to be an actor, my parents fully supported that. They went just go for it. Me, actually, now, I'll be honest with you, I prefer it if my kids didn't come to me and say that they wanted to be an actor. I think I'd be more up for them being an artist in a way, because I know how brutal it is being an actor, and I know, although it's been brilliant for me at times, the industry itself and the people that you have to deal with, because I've experienced that firsthand, has been quite challenging at times. Whereas if they suddenly had this amazing talent for art, I'd say, go on, just go for it. Because you know what? Nothing's certain at the moment anyway. And I don't think anything has been for a long time. I mean, it isn't like the old days where if you got a trade, you'd be set for life. Or if you worked in a butcher's or you worked here, you'd be set for life. Because as has been proven, the world is a very topsy-turvy place.
Yeah. Well, that's a very interesting point. I think that certainly for kids to be doing something, I think ideally, which has a creative side, but also a practical side. I've got two daughters that are teenagers.
Oh my God, you got teenagers. How's that?
Yeah.
How are you coping?
It sort of has its moments. it's generally good. I mean, they're great. And they're both, you know, interested in creative things. None of them seem to want to actually be artists, although they both have been done quite well with that side of things so far. But they're more interested in the kind of 3D design and all the kind of the areas around, sort of things where it's like creativity with an aspect of the practicality as well, which I think is great, because I think, as you say, the whole job for life thing may well be a complete thing of the past. In the next decade or two, so that's going to be a reality of life for them. That, you know, you will be doing something for a few years and quite possibly having to retrain or learn new skills every few years as you go along.
Well, I don't know what I'm going to do if I can't act or do voiceovers. But it's interesting. I mean, it has crossed my mind because of the uncertainty of the world. I'm hurtling towards 50, Jonathan, as you are, I believe. Are you 50 yet? Or are you still 40?
No, not quite.
Yeah, not quite, so we are hurtling towards... I think we should do like a dual self-portrait, you know, of two guys on the verge of a proper midlife crisis. Yeah. Because look, when I turned 40, I didn't care. 40 was like the new 30, but turning 50 is different. I feel like I'm on the precipice, you know. Yeah. I feel like, oh, this is what they talk about when they talk about a midlife crisis. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I haven't yet got the teardrop under my eye in a tattoo form. But I've certainly questioned my own mortality.
It's just a number. But it does kind of, in your mind, you know, start triggering off things that you, it kind of, you know, you start questioning what it was that you had meant to do in life. Because I think it's very easy to kind of, you know, to focus on the short term rather than the long term. And you're constantly thinking about what you want to get done in the next year or two. And forgetting about what you want to do in the next decade or so. And actually, when you get to a turning point like this, you start to think about the bigger picture again. And, you know, there may be a few things you'd meant to do in your 40s, which you haven't done yet. Hopefully, we got a few things done that were worthwhile in our 40s. But, and you think, well, actually, you know, 50s, that's all right. There's still time to get things done. But certainly in 20 years' time, you might think that the options are going to be kind of narrowing a bit. Time to get on with things.
Well, that's the scary thing, isn't it? Because if you think about how fast the last 20 years went, it went in the blink of an eye, right? So that's what suddenly hit me, because I was talking to Tuffers, and Tuffers went, we were doing a Zoom call, and Tuffers was saying that, I think it was his 54th, and then he called me after. He went, "How old are you, Craigie?" I said, "I'm 49. He went, "Oh." I said, "What do you mean, oh?" He went, "Well, 50's a bit of a blow." and so ever since that, he said that, about 4 months ago, I've hurtled into this mild panic. Partly stopped drinking because of it. I'm leaner than I've ever been. I'm probably healthier than I've ever been. So there's a lot of good things to have come from it. But I also, in terms of vanity, you know, I want to look good at 50. Do you know what I mean? I just wanted to go back to a kid's question, because it's quite a sweet one, because Frida is a real budding artist, and she's got two quick questions for you, you know, that are very relevant to her. And the first one is, what's your favourite colour?
Oh, wow, that's a difficult question to ask an artist. It's a good question, though,
Yeah.
That's a really good question. It does change from time to time. I mean, I find that I've been very interested in green for a while, partly because obviously a lot of my life is doing skin tones. One way or another, and green is, it's a wonderful color, both as a sort of as a juxtaposition. So you put it as a background, it pushes the sort of like skin tone, the figures forward. But also, there's a lot more green in skin tones than I think we realize. I mean, Lucian Freud's work has sort of shown that. We think of people being sort of like sort of brownish pink, but actually, you look at your own hands and face, you realize there are different patches and areas of very different things. It's it's often when you put the sort of green into skin tones that suddenly the thing comes alive, weirdly.
You
think
it's
the other way around.
That's incredible.
So, I think there's interesting things about all the colors. But I think that interests me a lot. And also, I've got, you can't see it now, but when you do come around to the studio,
you'll
see that sort of two of the spaces, I've painted sort of variations of murky dark greens, and it's very effective because it does make the place much more interesting. Because it makes, you know, all the, suddenly, as soon as the walls aren't white anyway, it makes the room more interesting, and you suddenly notice the objects in it and the paintings and everything else, except, you know, aren't distracted by the walls. But also, if you get the colours right, it can be a sort of warmish. I suppose it's more, this one I'm in now is more of a murky green brown sort of colour. It's the one that's in the studio app that you've got. Sort of the wall colour in that. And then the other studios are more of a kind of Georgian, slightly bluey green again. But there's definitely a warmth to it. It's not kind of like, you know, kind of like a hot colour that's sort of like, you know, kind of makes everything on it look cold.
Green.
Yeah, so I say green. Green's my favourite colour at the moment.
And you mentioned Freud there. Was he a hero of yours? Was he an influence in your work?
Yeah, I'd say he's definitely an influence. Seeing his work and realising that it a really sort of great artist, painter especially, can make you look at the world in a slightly different way. I think you know, a lot of us look at skin differently having seen his work. I think he saw skin tones better than any artist who's ever lived.
Yeah, he's incredible, isn't he?
Yeah, the flip side is that he wasn't so good at drawing. He was so good at colour.
Yeah.
Often the things were distorted or foot was going out of the picture and that sort of thing. Of course, that became his sort of like, you know, his signature in a way.
Yeah.
But it's a reminder that, you know, you don't have to be good at everything if you do something particularly well.
Yeah.
And I think, so certainly, yes. And I was very happy to sort of get to know him very slightly in the last few years of his life. And it was always fascinating learning things from someone who's been around, you know, doing the same thing basically over and over for 60 years or so.
How was that to meet him then? I mean, going to paint him then?
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I didn't paint him, sadly, but I mean, I think I don't know if anyone painted him. Other than
you did a homage though to him, though, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I was using kind of collage.
Yeah, but you met him though, so at least you got to meet him, so you got an essence of the man.
Yeah, yeah. He was a very, very focused person, and you know, he kind of spent most of his waking hours painting and didn't sort of like stop at weekends or Christmas or any other holidays.
He just kept painting.
He kept painting. And I don't think he was that... I mean, he was interested in people because they were interesting, but he didn't, I don't think, particularly value human relationships so much. You sort of see that in his paintings.
You know,
the sort of people are all kind of like quite cold and distant and rarely
cold,
even make eye contact.
That's right.
The animals, on the other hand, are painted very sympathetically. And,
very warm and fuzzy.
Feel like, yeah, exactly. A unique person and artist, really.
Yeah.
It always makes life more interesting if the kind of artist whose work you like also have interesting personalities.
You've painted some incredible people, but I just wanted to just ask you about, because it intrigues me actually. I want you to ask you about the George Bush painting.
Mm-hmm.
But why specifically did you want to do that portrait in that way?
Yeah, so that was the first of the collages I did.
Yes.
With a lot of them, I used porn mags to make the picture for multiple reasons.
Yes.
Initially, because my style breaks faces up a bit anyway. Certainly a lot of the kind of paintings I do. And they look a bit collagey. And I'd been thinking about how, you know, if you're going to make a collage, then that would be the obvious source material because it's all skin tone.
I love that. Go on.
Well, yeah. And then, of course, yeah, obviously it wouldn't be a sort of very flattering thing to do. So I'd have to choose the right subject. Anyway, parallel to that, I also got this commission to do a painting of then President Bush. And it was during his first term. I think he didn't think he was going to, you know, kind of win the 2004 election.
Yeah.
But then he did after the war and all that. And then the kind of commission, they didn't officially cancel it. They just, they like sort of started delaying it and then eventually stopped returning my calls. And this is after having made me do all kinds of preliminary sketches and give them a whole lot of spiel about how I was going to do it. And
so you were commissioned by his people?
Yeah, exactly. It was the people building the Bush Presidential Library, which all presidents have.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Even the ones that don't read books. And so it was kind of like that. And I'd done a bit of sort of prep work, which I was a bit sort of mildly grumpy about. And I suddenly had this idea, well, maybe it'd be quite fun to try out this collage idea.
Oh, it's genius, mate.
And if it works well, then maybe I can send it over and they might, if it's really effective and subtle, maybe they won't even notice.
They might just go for it.
Yeah, and so I did it, and actually, it took much longer than I expected, but it did work surprisingly well.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Around the same time, I started working with a gallerist called Steve Lazaridis, who'd been doing all Banksy stuff.
And
he got very started about it. He got very excited, and then he sort of said, "Oh, you got to let me show it in my gallery."
Yes,
which we did, and of course, then it went sort of viral, and
so
then
global,
we missed the chance to send it over, and it not be spotted, I think.
Brilliant.
That's how that happened. And then it worked so well, I ended up doing two exhibitions of that sort of work, one here and one in America.
Yeah.
They were sort of more popular than paintings for a while, but then eventually they were very slow to make. but also it got, you know, off the iPads and things came along, then sort of, you know, kind of this specialist magazines we used to get started getting harder and harder to come by.
Yeah.
So I kind of went on to other things after 2 or 3 years, but it was a funny little interlude.
Yeah, well, it really stood out to me. I think it's a great story. I think it was a genius idea. Can I just ask you, have you got a favourite portrait that you've done? Do you have a favourite one that, what, if I had to put you on the spot, which of course I'm doing, have you got a favourite?
I don't have a specific favourite. There are certain ones which I think mean a lot to me. I think one significant to me particularly is the first commission I ever did, which is 25, 26 years ago. Trevor Huddleston, who was the president of the anti-apartheid movement, had been the famous like political religious figure. And that was definitely one which, you know, that stage, it was a bit hit and miss when I did a portrait. I hadn't been doing it very long. Sometimes it would go well, sometimes it would go very badly.
Really?
And I started it and it was going badly. And then I said one day, would you mind if I started it again? And he looked a bit surprised, but said, no, that's fine. And the second one went well from the start. And it was really just a couple of days' work. But it really opened my eyes to the fact that, you know, you these things don't always go in a linear way. And, you know, if you get on a roll with something, you can do it very quickly. Just trying to get yourself into that sort of zone to do it. And to this day, it still stands out and still reminds me a bit of the work I'm doing now. And then, yeah, there's a bit of other little mini favourites along the way. But I still think that one was probably the most important one for me, because that it put me slightly on the map. People would then kind of come and ask me to do it, which wasn't happening otherwise.
Yeah. When you do your first painting, I was watching a little video when you were doing Tom Hollander. And you said that you like to get your first draft in quite quickly. Is that right? Is that something that you do? Your first kind of stab at it is just because then I presume it's very instinctive, right?
Yeah, it's a good point. I forgot I said that, but it's absolutely true that I think the danger is that you can like spend too long planning it or being too meticulous or thinking it has to be accurate. And actually sometimes, very often the best things, you just like go steaming in. And very often you end up doing something a bit different from what you planned because of the speed gives it a sort of energy. It also means if you're getting it wrong, you know about that quicker, so you don't waste too much time on it. It's not always easy to do that because sometimes, you know, you want to do something more complex, you want to plan it out, and you tend to be a bit more sort of, you know, cautious going into it. Yeah. And that sometimes goes well, but it's certainly, it's hardly ever a bad thing to just, you know, and I think maybe what I was saying was in the context of doing a portrait of someone, I'll often do one or two studies first in paint, which means, you know, sometimes it means that, you know, if you're going to make mistakes, then you've got them out of the way.
Yeah.
If they go well, then that's a bonus. It's a good thing to do. It's sometimes not to think about it too much and just get stuck in.
Just do it. I can still see the total love that you have for your work. Mm. And it's like, obviously, it's when I say obviously, it's just a presumption in the same way I feel this about Freud, where it's a bit of a obsession. It's like it's your world, right? But to keep up that level of love for your craft when you're so busy and you've reached the top of your game, how do you motivate yourself? Is it just because you love doing it?
I think there is that. I think that I do get bored of a thing quite easily, and therefore you tend to try and vary things to keep it interesting. I think part of the reason I get sort of pulled off into these side projects, like the ones we were talking about, is because I find if I do the same thing, you know, month in, month out, I get bored of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, another year it might have been I've done an exhibition of a different kind of work. This year it's obviously been the COVID project.
Yes.
It means that when I do come back to doing, you know, just a sort of like more standard portrait, and I haven't been doing it for a while, I am excited about it because I still love doing that.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, when I was younger, I had to do a lot of commissions and things like that to sort of pay the bills.
Yeah.
I sometimes find if I was doing like the third or fourth one in a row, I was starting to lose interest in the whole thing. And then that meant that I would do it less well and it would take longer. And that then becomes a bit of a sort of vicious cycle.
Yeah.
Whereas this way, you know, I still do a couple of commissions a year, but hardly ever more than that.
Yeah.
It just means that, you know, the majority of the work is stuff which I've chosen to do.
Yes.
And particularly, sometimes you still get into that situation if you're like doing an exhibition. If you're, you know, in recent years, I've done a lot of quite big shows.
You have.
And you have to plan it like a year or more in advance, and you've got a pretty tough deadline. The museum isn't going to want us delay an opening by a month if you haven't quite
You haven't got your act together.
And plus you've got the book deadlines and all that sort of thing. So that's the only time it comes up still, is when I've done 2/3 of the works of exhibition and I quite enjoyed it, but I'm starting to get bored. I want to do something else.
Yeah.
But you have, you've got no choice.
Yes.
So that, of course, because you're committed.
What's your next big project? Can you tell me what you're excited about next? What is coming up? Have you got any exhibitions? Have you got anything that you're working on that you can tease me with?
Well, I mean, it's things are slightly up in the air still. There were some things we were planning at the beginning of the year, which are on hold.
Yeah.
I'd love to do, I've got a couple of exhibition projects which will happen at some point, but I don't know quite when that'll be, because at the moment it feels a bit mad to be doing something where you're only going to get potentially a sort of small proportion of the audience. Therefore,
yes.
I'm kind of diverting some of the energy into doing things which people can experience remotely.
Yes.
I think that's going to carry on being a focus, and actually it's an interesting, I think, opportunity to potentially anyway widen the sort of audience for the work and work in a slightly different way. I'm still doing painting.
Yeah.
But I think that, I suspect the next few years are going to carry on being a sort of this twin thing of on doing the paintings and
hybrid
experimenting, because we're not doing exhibitions, and it's a better time for experimenting when you're not up against those exhibition deadlines, the reasons we just said.
Yeah.
But also exploring the technology model. There's such a massive opportunity for artists using technology at the moment, and there are only a handful of artists, I think, who are doing it really well. And that includes things like AI, I think, is going to be a huge area, which people are barely beginning to understand at the moment, the opportunities for artists. You have things like generative adversarial networks I've been learning about, which is a kind of where the machine learning means it can interpret the style of an artist and potentially make the work for you, steered by you.
Will that not take your work away?
I think there'll be a lot of debate about it in a few years' time. I mean, basically, I don't think it's quite there yet, but I think it's already interesting, and I think it'll shake the art world in about a decade's time.
I think it will.
But there's huge opportunity for artists in that. And then I think virtual reality and 3D imaging and all the stuff around that is fascinating. And then also bringing kind of computer game mechanics into storytelling generally in entertainment. But I think in art will be a huge thing as well.
Yeah.
And so all these things, I'm not sure that they're right for me to explore all those areas. I explore them a bit, but it's going to be such a fascinating time. And I think, obviously painting will still be my main thing, but it's quite nice to spend a third of your time exploring these other areas.
You know, between what you've done with the FaceTime, right? And the way you normally work, are the results better with the when you normally work, or are you finding that the results are just as good for you when you do the FaceTime portraits?
Yeah, I mean, I'd still feel there's, I could do a slightly better job when I see someone in the flesh.
Yeah.
For two reasons. I think one part of it is that literally you see a bit more, because you're using two eyes, whereas through a screen you're seeing, what's been compressed into a single viewpoint from the camera and less lighting information. And, it's not quite as real, but it's less three-dimensional. But I think also the ones I've done so far work because I know those people, most of them pretty well.
Yeah.
And so I think what would be difficult doing remotely is the way you get to know someone when you don't know them already.
Yes.
In person, in the room. And I think we've all been experiencing that this year.
Yes.
In a way that is just a bit more instinctive and natural and real than if you're doing it remotely. And I think part of that is because we instinctively, pick up on body language and all kinds of, sort of non-verbal signals when you're in a room much more easily. So I think that I'd still, if I'm starting from scratch doing a portrait or any kind of painting of someone when I don't know them very well, then it's going to be better doing it that way. Having said that, definitely what happens over the FaceTime is you look at people in a slightly different way. The animation almost becomes more pronounced, And even the way the kind of sometimes the pixelation and other kind of problems with the sort of bandwidth of it actually kind of exaggerate some of the sort of stylistic things that I do anyway. And so what I'm thinking now is I might try and use a bit of that in portraits, even when people can come and sit in the actual studio.
What, so like because a hybrid? It
does, yeah, exactly. So I do some of the sittings here, maybe some of them like that, because then I think you'll get something slightly different again. And that was sort of the next thing to experiment with, really, is whether the hybrid is better than either of the kind of other ways by themselves.
I think it sounds like it could be amazing. I think that's a great idea. And I'll tell you why. It's just occurred to me because, let's face it, we're all energy, right? And sometimes they think you can see energy. You know, like when you get psychics and those kind of people that deal in energy.
Yeah.
They can see colours around people. So I like that's that, true. You know, that idea of the pixelation on the old Zoom calls.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
It's straight true, actually. I forgot about that. But people pick up on different things psychically, but there are certainly people who literally see colours around people.
Yes, they do.
And actually, I forgot about that. I wonder if you can look at any of painters' work. I was looking at Matisse recently with my kids and like talking about, and actually with other people, just looking about the way he uses colours next to the sort of like faces and stuff. In very dramatic ways, to sort of, which I always read as playing with the sort of idea of space around someone and suggesting movement and other things. But actually, maybe there are artists like him who actually saw those things too. Sadly, I'm not conscious of doing that. I mean, I think some people do have that. So yeah, I'm going to explore that more and see what other artists are doing.
Well, Jonathan, I'm going to send you some pictures, okay? Why I'm talking about this is because I work with a shaman. Right. And basically, I did a film which was inspired by the work that I did with her. It's essentially working with energy. And why I'm just saying this is because we did a session recently and she took some photographs during the session. Right. And I'll send them to you because they're quite amazing, and we're talking about a pixelation, and she's saying at this point this is when your energy wasn't clear and we were having that chat about that thing and that thing, and then this was when you were talking about that, and then at the end this is you after you've been cleansed, right, after your energy is clear. And it's very, very trippy, and I'm going to send them to you because you're an artist.
I'd love to do that.
And just have a look. And yes, you can put it down to bad Wi-Fi, and yes, you can say, okay, well, perhaps your signal wasn't great, but I think there's something in it, and I just like this idea of capturing that in its essence with the use of the Zoom. You know, I think there's something in that.
Maybe it was distorting the digital images.
Well, yeah,
it's fascinating.
I will send you these pictures, right, and you let me know. And there's a few things that I want to say just before we go, because you've been very, very generous with your time, Jonathan. It's been brilliant to talk to you, mate. You're such a great guest. But I'd love to come and see you in your studio. I'd love to just have a cup of tea with you, mate.
Yeah, you must.
It would be, you know, it'd be a real honour.
I'd love that.
Okay, I've got it recorded now, Jonathan. So if you don't...
Yes, exactly.
Kelly's Heroes.
Just before we go, Jonathan.
Yeah.
I'd like to know your favourite song, please, sir.
Something like Walk on the Wild Side.
Okay.
Because I thought maybe you could sing it and I could do the do.
Do you know the lyrics for that? What's the first line? What's the first line? Took a walk on the wild side.
Holly came from Miami, FLA.
What, so, Holly came from Miami, West LA.
Yeah, and hitchhiked away across the USA.
Hitchhike away across the USA. Put some lipstick on, and he was a she. And all the people say do 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 do. Go on, keep doing that. Go on.
That's I think we need to practice that a bit more.
Mate, I love it. I got you singing finally. I knew that that would be tough. Well, I got you, man, and you sung beautifully. And thank you so much for doing this, Jonathan. You're an absolute star, mate. I think you're a wonderful artist, and I think that you're a great guy. And thank you so much for your time. And that's it, mate.
Thanks for asking me, Craig. It's lovely to catch up again. Well, do you know, it's really interesting you've done this experiment, because actually the FaceTime portraits I did were, I think, a bit of a similar thing. Yeah. I was, basically they're kind of. Partly, obviously, it's partly I'm painting them, but it's also partly not quite an interview, but it's very much about the conversation.
Yes.
And what happened was, and I've never, because of course I've never sat and watched myself paint the portrait before. And no. Then because afterwards I watched a bit of it back, I noticed a lot of things about the way I work, which I hadn't really been aware of.
You didn't know.
But one of the things was, of course, and it's especially the case with people like Dexter and Brian Cox, where you've got interesting, entertaining people there. But when I was, when I'm doing the painting, you can also see what I'm doing on the screen.
Yeah.
And basically, when the conversation got really interesting, the painting would definitely get worse. So I get quite distracted by it. In Dexter's case, because Dexter was funny, and in Brian's case, it's because I was trying to keep up with the clever things he was saying.
Yeah. Is that your ADD coming in there, though? Is that what that is?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It must be that. I can't do both at once. Whereas when I was, there's a lot of time, when the painting's going well and I can see it, I'm sort of nodding and giving the impression I'm listening to them. Yeah. But actually I'm not. And then, of course, at some point I'll get exposed because Dexter's taking the piss out of me, or Brian was saying something which was obviously got far too in-depth for me to really understand.
Yeah, so switched off.
but obviously you don't have that problem.
Look, mate, honestly, I still think there might be something in this. I don't know how I'd get myself checked. I've certainly the way my mind works, I wouldn't say it was normal, if that's the best way. But in a good way, do you know what I mean?
I can send you some, when I see you, I can tell you a bit more about it.
Okay, I would like to speak to someone about it, because my wife's been saying for 15 years, you have got that. You've got ADD. She's convinced. So it'd be really interesting, because it's a win-win for me, because if I haven't got it, I'll go, see, I told you, you're wrong. And if I have got it, I'll go, well, it just means I'm very interesting and very, very creative. In fact, it's my creative superpower.
It's always good to have a bit more knowledge about yourself and your own head, I think. I can happily sort of steer you towards some people who know about these things.
You're a legend, Jonathan. I've loved talking to you. Thank you so, so much for doing this. You're a joyful person, mate, and the joy in your voice and the joy about your work, and it's just been really, really lovely to catch up.
Well, likewise. It's great, and I'm very impressed that you're doing it. So I can't wait to hear it. I probably won't be listening to the musical bit at the end. But...
that will be the best part. I'm gonna send you those photographs right now.
Yes.
Brilliant, Jonathan.
You lovely man. So good to catch up.
Great to catch up, mate. Loads of love.
I'll look at your pictures and let's talk soon.
Okay. Right, brilliant. Bye, mate. Thank you again. Bye, cheers, Jonathan.
Next time on Kelly's Heroes. Join me as I delve through my phone book and speak to some fabulous people in the world of showbiz. Until then, stay happy.